Broadcasting Network. The views and opinions presented in this program do not necessarily represent those of WGBB or its employees. You're listening to 1240 WGBB.
The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
From the heart of the nautical mile, you're listening to the station that serves your community. AM 1240 WGBB.com and 1240 WGBB Freeport. Wellness.
Don't touch that dial. No, it's not him. It's a wonderful time to be here and enjoying this wonderful occasion today with Dr. Chiffer and lovely wife. I have the privilege of working with them for over 5 years, and it's an opportunity to be here to witness. They're celebrating 5 years on their fifth anniversary with one of the best show here on WGBB. And they call me the preacher man, but I'm Trevor Vaslin. It's my honor. And before to do, for 5 years consecutive running, here is Dr. Chiffer.
GBB, Long Island's oldest radio station. This is the most listened to show on WGBB. It's time for...
Listen Up, Jesus is on the Air.
And that was the lovely Joan Chiffo, my bride. I'm Dr. Anthony Chiffo, and our co-host is Brother Paul Miller. And we're here to tell you we're three young kids, and we love Jesus.
Yes, we do.
And thank you, listeners. Thank you for listening. Brother Paul,
yes.
Welcome. Thank you for being our co-host. And thank you
it's
for being...
It's a very auspicious occasion to be here at the fifth anniversary.
Yes, and you were part of our show, of our program, since day one. And by the way, I also want to mention, Trevor has been our engineer for 262 shows, never missed a date, and we love the guy tremendously. So we got, Brother Paul, we have a guest that I think you would be very interested in talking to, and his official name is Jim Spencer, and he's a doctorate student, and he specializes in... Catholic medical ethics, if I'm saying that correctly. And that's what he's going for his doctorate with. So before we introduce Spence, he wants to be called, and before we introduce Spence, I just want to mention, I want to thank you, all the listeners, for contributing to helping keeping Dr. Palmer's legacy alive and to continue doing this radio show. Your contributions are greatly appreciated. If anyone wishes to make a contribution, they can text me. They can go onto our website and go donate now, or they can just call me at 516-712-7005. 516-712-7005. And this is an open forum, by the way. We don't take calls, but if you have comments, you're more than welcome. More than welcome to text them to us. So let's get on with the show. So, Spence.
Good morning.
Good morning. Before we do that, Joan, there's a little something that you want to say about Al Barbarino,
oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
so
sure.
So let's get that off.
Okay, Al Barbarino. He'll be appearing at St. John's the Evangelist in Santa Mauritius, and he'll sing and speak at all the masses on the weekend and offer a parish mission this Monday and Tuesday night, January 9th and 10th at 7:30 p.m., beginning the new year with Jesus. And perhaps this is something that we should all consider to begin the new year resolution.
Oh, thank you. That was so beautifully said. Okay, so Spence, tell us a little something about your ministry and what you're looking to do. What's your mission statement here?
All right. So I've really only been here with Catholic Health Services for about 8 months. So Catholic Health Services, we have six hospitals on Long Island, three nursing homes. We have a home care division. It's a very wonderful place. I moved here from Iowa the time I came in, I had an interview with Tony Pelicano and Dr. Gersey, who's a wonderful president of the ministry, and Father Peter. And it was just an amazing feel for, I just felt at home. And then I got an acceptance letter and just flew back out a couple of weeks later, and it's just wonderful. And it's been a very, very welcoming community. I love Catholic Health Services. And Long Island.
And Long Island.
Yes.
Well, so being involved with Catholic medical ethics, and just very, you know, what does it mean? I mean, why is it necessary to have Catholic and a Catholic perspective medical ethics?
Well, I think, you know, we can do, ever since, you know, we've had the golden age of medicine back in the 50s, 60s, but the technology has really advanced, and we can do a lot of things to and for patients and persons. And I think the wisdom comes with knowing how to use that technology and that medical science to serve humanity. And I think the Catholic Church has a deep tradition and a lot of wisdom when it comes to service of humanity, not just Catholic, but all of humanity, and searching for the truth. So I think that it's underappreciated, and it's just, we have wonderful physicians, and they really are discerning, and they bring up those questions. The nurses talk with families and patients. What's the right thing to do in this particular situation? Oh. And sometimes it's, you know,
difficult,
fortitude and pressing
difficult
on.
Question.
Yeah,
difficult question.
Very difficult questions.
Now, Brother Paul, by the way, is a spiritual son of a Maria Espinanza, who was a servant of God, and he was chosen by Maria Espinanza to be a spiritual son. Selected out of all the people you could think of, they chose Brother Paul. She chose Brother Paul. And so she selected Brother Paul to be a spiritual son. And Brother Paul is accepted, but he's doing so many things to help mankind. He does a soup kitchen that he serves hundreds of thousands of meals a year. He does a coat drive, where he has a warehouse that looks like Macy's. People donate coats, and he gives coats to the poor. And he works for the poor. And he's a healer. He does a healing ministry, and a very powerful healing ministry. We'll talk a little bit more about that. But he has answered the call of Jesus to help the poor. I equate it with you that is answering the call to get medical ethics in line with a Catholic perspective. Am I right, Brother Paul? What's your thought?
Well, you know, I approach this subject from the most practical level, because within the healing ministry, I see people that are dying every day. And my ministry is, as Tony said, is very broad. It goes all over the United States, yes, outside the United States, and into 90 countries throughout the world. And I'm always being put on the spot in situations where people are dying. And so what's the right answer? For example, let's say that someone has slipped into a coma. You know, do we still feed them? I mean, that's a question that comes up, you know, practically every day. You know, what's the church's position? Do we continue to feed them and hydrate them, or do we, you know, just allow them to essentially slip away? You know, what I see for the most part in mostly secular hospitals is, you know, the doctors tend to recommend that if a person's in the coma, they just let them go. And so this is a very real question. And so for me, I look at medical ethics not as a sort of philosophical or even theoretical subject, but rather as a true moral issue that really needs to be defined. Hello?
Yes. Brother Paul, so you can equate Spence's ministry with your ministry, because you're doing prayovers over people thousands of times, and you're coming across their sick, they're they're looking for health care, they're looking for help, they're looking for medical assistance. And there's always a lot of questions. And then becomes the question is, how far do you go? How far do you go to try to save people's lives that are suffering?
Not only that, but it's interesting because I find that in my travels that when I go to see people who are in hospice or at home hospice or whatever, for the most part, people are ready to die. But it's their relatives and friends and the people that who are close to them, they're the ones suffering the question, what do I do? And so I think it's really, you know, useful if we could ask. Did you say we should call him Spence?
Yes, Spence.
Or whatever. To comment on that, you know, what should people do if they're faced with that situation? What's the right answer?
Yes, I could say that, you know, the Catholic Church has a very, very deep understanding of the dignity of the person. And it doesn't matter if the patient is in a coma, if the patient is addicted to medications, if the patient has a genetic or a physical malady, that person has genuine dignity made in the image and likeness of God, and we need to honor that and remember that. One of our values at Catholic Health Services is respect and reverence for the dignity of the person. So as we're providing health care, we need to be mindful of that dignity, that body-spirit entity that is real, and we treat them holistically, and sometimes there's difficult emotions in family relationships, and patients may want to allow natural death. And sometimes we get in the way of that. And I think the wisdom is the balance of the benefit and burden of the treatment from the patient's perspective. And the Catholic tradition has a lot to say about that. We use the term morally ordinary and morally extraordinary treatment. And I think we have an obligation to accept morally ordinary treatment. One of the examples that just seems so obvious is a 24-year-old comes in with appendicitis and they're in pain and they're willing to do anything. You know, your informed consent is a little weakened when you're in pain, and so we relieve the pain and the patient says, "Oh, I feel comfortable. I don't want to get that I don't want to have my surgery." And so I think rather than just say, let the patient go, you're free on your will, I think we have to have a good conversation to make sure that the patient understands. And the benefit burden in that situation is very, very positive in favor of having appendectomy. Mm-hmm. Now, a patient who's 70, 80 years old and has end-stage organ failures, diabetes, chronic diseases, and some of the treatments we're doing are just extending or getting in the way of natural death. And so we need to use the wisdom and dialogue with the patient value system. I know one person when I was in Iowa, he was from Laos, and he was in a coma and unable to speak, but he... his value system in talking through interpreters with his family, he was very much a fighter his whole life, fought some of the oppression and in the wartime there. Mm-hmm. And his family members said from his perspective, he wouldn't want to fight to the bitter end. And so they said, the son and the mother, that, well, this may not be what we would want for ourselves, but for our father, he would want to fight. And it was something that was very unpopular with us. He went from the nursing home back and forth twice. And he died, and they feel that they honored his value system, which might be different from them. I think it's very difficult when you're a healthcare professional and you kind of have seen over the time, well, we do this, and maybe we try these treatments, and they don't generate a positive outcome, and we're just delaying maybe 3 weeks down the road that we can, not with 100% accurately, but foretell kind of the way the prognosis is going to go. And it may be unpopular with us, but we need to honor the patient's value system. And clearly, the Catholic tradition has a way of doing that. And there are times where patients may request things that are against the church's understanding of how we would do that. And so we might not do something, or we might recommend something different. But there's a way to dialogue with patients and family and balance that. And Brother Paul mentioned that family members sometimes don't want to let go when the patient is already reconciled. And I've been in situations where once they feel permission and they have their say their goodbyes, there's something spiritual that the patient can just can pass and be with God.
So all these treatments are relative to the person's age and physical and emotional state at that time.
Yes.
Yeah.
And they are important. The circumstances important to that particular family, and I think we need to use the wisdom and still be objective. You know, there's a subjective component to morally ordinary, morally extraordinary treatment conversations, and there's an objective piece. In our Catholic tradition, we have something called the ethical and religious directives, and it really looks where the church teaching, ethics, and medical healthcare kind of intersect. And one of our directives talks about the presumption in favor of nutrition and hydration. So there is a presumption in favor of feeding, but sometimes artificial nutrition and hydration can get into the, can cause some burdensome feelings and actually make death more suffering. So we have Dr. Carrie Ann Page, who's, she's a palliative care board certified physician and senior vice president of our hospice and palliative care division. Wonderful, wonderful woman. She's actually speaking at the diocesan-hosted conference on physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia in February.
So, Spence and Brother Paul, and I know Brother Paul gets involved in the situation by his prayers and stuff like that. What's your best recommendation to people, to parishioners, to loyal Catholics, to be able to face such a situation and make a decision that doesn't violate the ethical practices of the Catholic Church? How's that done?
I think we need to know the Catholic tradition, and I think there's spiritual guidance, and there's our priests, and our physicians who we could talk with. Advanced directives are something that is a document that's used to kind of work through the who's going to be speaking for me if I can't speak for myself. It would be great if a patient could have a dialogue with their spouse or family member to say, if I'm in a condition like that I'm unable to speak for myself, this is kind of how I would want things to go. Now, we don't have a crystal ball that we can't. Your advanced directive, if you wanted to cover everything, it would be longer than a dissertation. It would be 7,000 pages, because we can't predict everything. But we need to have maybe some persons in our life who kind of know us. and I think you can get good counsel from your priest and your physician.
I'm just thinking about that. And I'm sure there's been plenty of people that have sought counsel from you, Brother Paul. Is that correct? On how, what's the ethical thing to do? What's the right thing to do? And how do you pray over something like that? Have you ever had that situation, Brother Paul?
Oh, totally, all the time. And,
yeah.
And you know, of course, my overriding theological approach to all this is, you know, God chooses the time of death. I've thousands of cases where people were supposed to die on Tuesday, and on the 3 weeks from then, they're still alive and they haven't changed. So those kinds of issues are always looming, you know, around this whole subject. You know, a couple of years ago, well, maybe it's more than a few years ago now, I'll give you a real-life example of what I'm talking about. I was visiting someone. I was having dinner with someone whose daughter was in a terrible car accident, absolutely terrible car accident. And this woman was grieving greatly over it because her 17-year-old daughter's body was just totally, practically destroyed, but nothing involving her head was involved. There was no head trauma. So I said to her, well, you know, will you, I'm willing to go bless her, even though it's a few hours from here, if you'll drive me there. And so we got in the car, and we drove across the state to this hospital. And as we were there, she said, the strangest thing happened to me today. I was with my daughter in the ICU, and this woman who I didn't even know came up to me, and she said, can I talk to you? And, of course, the woman said, of course. She said, well, I'm really in a quandary. I don't know what to do. The doctors and nurses are telling me to pull the plug on my husband. What should I do? And so she said, well, the woman said, well, I don't really believe in that, but I'll pray for you. So she told me this story, and I was really affected by it. I got to the hospital and went to visit the girl and prayed for her. And while I was there, it was almost midnight, and while I was there, I said, is that person still here? Because her husband had a brain operation, and there was no brain activity after the operation. So anyway, I said, is that person still here? She said, I don't know. I said, well, go find out. So she left, and she came back a few minutes later, and she said, yes, he's still here. So I said, well, I'm here. I'm never at this hospital. You know, it's a unique opportunity. Why don't you find out if they want me to pray for him while I'm here? So she goes back, and she comes back a couple minutes later, and she says, she can't. She's Jewish. She doesn't know if that's okay. So I sort of laughed, and I said, well, you know, it's fine. It's the same God. So, you know, if she's willing, I'm certainly willing to go pray for him and for her. And so I said, so go back and ask her. So she went back and asked her, came back. She said, she would love to if you would do that. So I said, okay. So she took me down to where the area was in the ICU, where this man was. And there was a doctor and a nurse who was literally badgering this woman while I was standing. That her husband was dead and to pull the plug. And I was just in horror watching it. Because here's this woman who was so obviously grieving terribly, and here they were badgering her. Well, anyway, they wouldn't even get out of the way so I could go over to pray for the man. So I went around the room, and I climbed through all the wires and tubes and came through the other side, and I went up to the man who was looked like he was dead. He was laying on this stretcher, and I put my hand on him. I started to pray, and all of a sudden, his chest heaved up a couple of inches. It was shocking. Anyway, I prayed, and then I left the jail, and I left, the room. And I never said anything to anybody, and they were still arguing with the woman. Anyway, the next day, this woman found me through someone else to tell me that her husband had sat up and started talking right after that. That's the reality of what happens every day. And there was no one there to help this woman. And that's where I think the real need is. You know, the church's position obviously is very complicated, but I see a lack of people on the scene. You know, even the priests I've run into in the various areas, a lot of them don't have a real understanding or training in this. And so I really am interested myself to know, what is the church doing to educate the priests who are the primary spiritual directors of the people that are in their parishes?
Yeah, that's a good point, Brother Paul. That's an excellent point. As a matter of fact, as you were talking, the thought came about, you know, we're putting our lives into some of our family's hands. Like, my life is definitely put into my lovely bride's hands, and who I trust explicitly. As a matter of fact, I trust her so much that if she ever says to me, go jump off the bridge, I would be looking forward to doing it. That's how much I trust her. But the question is,
would I ever do that?
Would you ever do that? There's a distinction between killing or murdering
and allowing someone to die peacefully. That's a tough distinction. I mean, and I still to this day am not sure what the Catholic Church's view is. I'm not sure if I was put into that position, what would I do? What's your thought, Spence?
Yeah, there's a couple of really good books. When you asked about, you know, how could we learn a little bit about this, David F. Kelly from Duquesne University is a priest and an ethicist and very, very well-versed. He's a little bit, well, I think he's retired now. And Dr. Jerry McGill, who's trained in Rome as well, as they've written a couple of books. Medical Care at the End of Life by David Kelly is a really, really good book. And he really talks about kind of a consensus of three things. One is we can do a lot of things to and for patients or persons that are not beneficial to them. There is a distinction between killing and allowing to die. And people have some liberty or choice in their healthcare decisions. And the first two are more ethical. The third one is more legal. But I think we need to appreciate there is that ethical distinction between actual killing and allowing to die. And I've been at the bedside when patients who have been treated with medications, and maybe shortly after you give an injection, the patient dies. But that if we're properly treating the patient, their death is caused by the underlying condition. Their death is not caused by a medication we gave. Now, we could intentionally kill someone and give an overdose, but I think that fine distinction, and I've actually talked with physicians and nurses, and there's an eerie feeling about maybe did I do something that caused? And I think it's important to understand the facts that if we are, maybe our hospice folks and our palliative care folks, Dr. Carrie Ann Page would be wonderful to come in and talk on this topic. But when
let's get her.
Yeah, she's amazing.
Let's get her.
And very knowledgeable ethically and medically. And by the way, it's best to have ethics practice at the bedside and not by a committee. So I think it's really, really good. But if we are properly treating the pain, we're titrating the medication to the pain, we don't cause the death. Mm-hmm. Now, some people talk about could we hasten the death? And there's the the principle of double effect, which helps us handle a situation that simultaneously does one action cause a good effect and a bad effect, not sequentially. And the church is really, really good at that. But I think in this case, if we are properly taking care of the pain and titrating the medication to the pain, we never cause the death of the patient. They mm-hmm. die of that underlying condition.
At God's will.
Yes.
Yeah. And I think that's the key, isn't it?
Yes.
I mean, it just hit me like, yeah, it's my will when I'm going to let someone pass on.
Right.
I think that's beautiful. By the way, breaking news. I don't want to interrupt. But, you know, this is a grassroots program, and I did open it up to messages and texts and stuff like that. And so we got two texts. One text says, Paul Miller, I'm praying to be with him at St. Mary's in February. So looking forward to his appearance and to have him pray over me. And I'm loving Spencer so far. Great topic. Okay. Wow. And also, I got another one that says, I dare you to jump off the bridge when Joan tells you to. I may just do that, though. Well, anyway, thank you, listeners. Thank you for your text messages. I love when you guys listen to the show and text us, and it's an open, it's a grassroots show, and it's for you, and it's for the parishioners, and it's for the parishes within the diocese. So thank you. I'm sorry for interrupting.
When you were talking, it made me think of our physicians that at CHS. One of our physicians, I might want to say Dr. Rabinowitz. You know, it's really, really nice. There have been situations where he and I have talked where here's a patient who has not, doesn't have an advance directive and doesn't have a family member to be able to speak for him. And here's where it's really nice to have conscientious well-grounded physicians and nurses that are looking out for what's best for this particular patient.
And by the way, I got another text. Great topic.
All right.
And if you want to text us, but I don't know if I mentioned to you, you can text me at 516-712-7005. 516-712-7005.
Especially if they have a question.
005, if you have a question.
Yes.
And also, while Joan just chimed in, you can also text us at 516-712-7004. Joan would get that text.
Okay.
But don't say nothing bad about me if you're going to text Joan, okay, please? Okay, so.
And there's no substitute for a loving family either. I've been in situations where family members really struggle. What's the best thing to do for mom or dad or a brother or sister or a loved one? There's no substitute.
And it must be hard even if there is a directive.
Yes.
You know, because how can you make that decision? It's just.
And we interpret what they said.
Right. There could be a directive, but you think, oh, but this may not be the time. I'm thinking that it's the end. Maybe it's not.
I have a great story, and I tell you, you cannot make up these situations. This is a situation where having an aneurysm at the base of your brain is usually not the best prognosis. And I'm not, you know, into the neuroscience of all of this, but our physicians have told me. And this one particular patient was found at home, sitting in the chair, and recently had an aneurysm, and not, it wasn't delayed, but they were rushed to a local hospital, a community hospital. And then the situation of the family members is the daughter is a stroke rehab nurse in Arizona. Hmm. The son is a faith healer in Oregon.
Wow.
And his other sibling, who is the durable power of attorney, is with the mom in one of the Midwest states. And they're struggling with the three what to do. They reluctantly, you know, emergency situations, they do the surgery, the patient gets transferred to a larger hospital, and then the patient's in the intensive care unit, and they're making decisions about placing a feeding tube, and the patient is going to has a probability that she could maybe wake up and communicate. But here's the discussion. The nurse says, oh, I've seen these situations before, and they don't go well, and I don't want to. If mom's not going to really recover well, I don't want to consent to the feeding tube. The son says, you know, we want to do that. If mom just can sit on the Pacific Ocean in a rocking chair and view the ocean, I'll pray with her, and we should do that. And then the other son, who's the durable power of attorney, he's in the middle of this and is working to kind of dialogue. And then I said, talking with the family, why don't we give it a few days? You know, she just had the surgery. Mm-hmm. And I know the prognosis is not good, but maybe we could communicate with her as she gets a little better. Let's feed her and see if we can give it some time. Well, she got better after about 4 or 5 days. She transferred to a medical unit, and she's starting to heal. And then we said, well, we'll talk. We'll meet every day, the neurosurgeon. And we're standing by the bedside, and on one side is the daughter saying, oh, squeeze my hand if you want to die.
Oh.
The other one, and so, oh, she squeezed my hand. She wants to die. The son, the faith healer, squeeze my hand if you want to live. Oh, she squeezed my hand. Yeah. And so we interpret things maybe
the way we want it.
Yes, and so we said, it's still too soon. You know, we don't want to rush this decision, because if we withdraw everything, that's the end. So, and sometimes the folks are willing to, you know, well, if the family makes a decision and they want to pull the plug, I'll go along with that. It's not what I would do. And sometimes we agree, and sometimes we don't. And so we gave this a little bit of time. And here's where you need to be mindful of the dignity of the person. And we don't know as much as we think we do. After a few days, the patient kind of got a little alert. And she said, I could hear you talking.
Oh, I know.
That happens all the time.
I know that. It happened with my mother.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. So she got better, and she told us, I want to fight to live. Here was something with a very low probability, but she walked out of the hospital with a medication that costs about $24 a month, and I have checked with her for three and a half years later.
That
she's
is
still,
amazing. Still aren't there.
Yeah.
So this thing about figure. Squeeze my hand if you want to die, well, if you say that to a person, what are you going to do? You're going to kill them? You're going to give them something to kill them?
It's in the hands.
That's like, it's in the hands of Jesus. Why say a thing like
that? It's in the, you know what? It's in the hands of Jesus.
It's in God's hands.
I smell a song.
You do?
Yes. Can we play
it? Which one do you smell?
You raise me up. Great song, selected by my bride, Joan Chiffo. Good song, Joan.
That's not necessary going, to say for every
I'm
song
sorry,
you know.
I'm all right, I'm sorry. You know, time is going so fast. I'm getting, having problems here trying to fit everything in. But Brother Paul, have you had any instances on situations such as Spence said, you know, if someone comes over and asks you to pray to make a decision, do you pray to help them make decisions? How does that work?
Oh, of course. I had a very parallel situation to what Spencer told just a few minutes ago, just before the song. I was asked to go to North Carolina to visit this family who's one of the brothers was in a coma, and he really didn't know what to do. And just exactly as Spencer described, each person, there was two doctors within the group, and there was the guy's best friend, and he was estranged to some of the brothers, sisters, and it was a complete mess. And they were practically choking each other, you know, trying to decide the fate of this poor man. And you know, I not by training, but I guess by instinct, I sort of did the same thing that Spence said. I said, why don't we wait a little bit here? You know, it happened very quickly. And actually, it was also I think the same condition, basically, sort of like an embolism or something like that. Anyway, so they did that, and we talked all about it. And I literally spent 2 days with them, the group, at the hospital, talking about, you know, how they should approach making this decision. And in the meantime, things took care of themselves. And after I left, the person passed away, and the family was very much at peace. So it was really more, you know, more a mission of mercy for the family, trying to understand the process of dying.
Which is
difficult. I mean, I've encountered it many, many times.
Which is very difficult to try to understand the problem. No one could really understand the problem but the person involved in Jesus. And it's between Jesus That's and right. the person involved, I think, personally. By the way, I just got another text. I do want to read it. And then, Spence, I know there's something that I want to ask you. And it says, this is my song. John always knew this was my song. And by the way, this is a great show. That's what she said.
Right,
okay,
story.
Spence, you have another story, don't you?
Yes, I wanted to say, once you've had a few of those stories where, you know, it looks like the prognosis is not good and people do well or better than expected, you get a little shy about maybe pulling the plug too soon. Mm. But on the other side, there are situations, and two come to mind. One is where we maybe take too long to make that decision, or we're too aggressive and we cause some additional suffering, getting in the way of natural death. One where, you know, it was really a prolonged, it was 11 children and difficulty coming to consensus and not wanting to push to withdraw treatment when objectively, you know, the medical professionals felt, you know, we're really causing some additional burden and suffering, and we should really intervene and kind of have a firmer discussion with the family. But even beyond that, there's situations, a term called brain death. I don't like that term. I like to say death by neurologic criteria, determined by neurologic criteria, because death can be determined medically. The physicians can determine death by irreversible cessation of the cardiopulmonary function or complete lack of function of the upper brain and the brain stem. And I got a call one day from the nurses. There was a patient who was declared dead by neurologic criteria, or the common term brain death, and asked us if we could continue to treat his wife for 30 days. And that was really unethical. But how do you have that conversation with a spouse? And I don't mean to be blunt, but we don't treat dead persons. And trying to explain compassionately that really all of this technology is perfusing a dead body. So I think that's clearly a time to stop. And then even beyond that, there's times before death is declared, we are causing additional suffering and getting in the way of natural death. So there's a balance here. It's, you know, when do we, when don't we? And I think we need to discern and pray and try to figure out what would this patient want, within the ethical parameters and make the best decision that we can. And then 6 months down the road, not beat up ourselves for trying to, you know, or, oh, Brother John did this and sister, we made the wrong decision. You need to have a loving family, have that dialogue with the patient ahead of time, and make the best decision and be guided by love, prayer, and facts.
Okay.
So if that happened, that situation where the man wanted to not pull the plug and treat her, well, what would you do in that case? Would you allow that, or does the hospital then take over?
Yes, that was a very difficult decision. I was at I was about 4 miles away, and I prayed the hardest I could pray on the way over to the hospital to have the conversation with the patient. And I really, when I sat in the room, I listened, and then I explained that at the time we had probably one of the best neurosurgeons on call that night. It was a winter, icy winter on the interstate, and it was a large motor vehicle accident, several cars involved. And I tell you, the physician that was on call, highly competent, very aggressive. And as I listened to the spouse, talked with him about the competency of the physician, and we were prayerful, and he came to that sense that, you know, she's not, her spirit's gone, and we didn't have to force the decision, and he made that decision on his own, and it was very, very nice. Now, there may be times where state law gets involved, and, you know, once you're declared dead, a lot of things happen. You don't have insurance anymore. You have life insurance. You're not married. You're, you know, there's a lot of things. Yeah. So those things kick into place. So I think we need to be mindful of that. And the important thing is, the patient was declared dead at 9 o'clock Monday night. And then when I called the nurses later on in the afternoon, they said, oh, it was wonderful. Spiritual care was involved. And the patient died at 3 o'clock. No. We withdraw treatment and we stop perfusing the body at 3 o'clock. But the patient actually died the day before at 9 o'clock at night.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Oh, wow. That's so confusing, though.
Yes.
I don't need to say this.
Okay. Quick question. And also to you, Brother Paul and Spence. If someone has a health proxy signed, how does that fit into the picture? Brother Paul, have you ever had a situation like that where you had to pray over someone that had a health proxy signed and would, like, don't treat, don't respirate, don't do this, don't do that? What's the story with this stuff, Brother Paul?
I have had that experience. In fact, I've had an even worse experience in that I was involved with a case where the family didn't really speak English that well, and they were brought in, the patient was brought into the hospital, and the family, it was an emergency situation, and there was, the death was imminent, and so they came out to visit the family and said, you know, is there an advance directive? What exists? And, okay, well, here's the papers. You sign this, do this, and then the person didn't die for an hour or two. But then all of a sudden, someone came to visit them and said, "Wait a minute, what? You know, are you just, you know, a priest actually came and said, you know, I'm going to do the last rites and or you know the anointing of the sick." So we're going to pray as the person passes away. And they said, well, we don't want him to pass away. So there was a big argument about getting this back and to try to revive the person.
Oh,
so,
wow.
And in fact, that's what happened. And the person lived another year. But those, you know, it's a really tough situation. It's an awful situation to be in. You know, it's greatly chaotic, and people are trying to make decisions at the most traumatic time of their life. you know, especially if you're talking about the death of a child. I mean, which is, in my experience, the worst possible trauma, is to watch one of your children die. You know, they're not even, you know, they're in such a terrible state. It's tough to make decisions under those conditions.
Oh, wow. Spence, what's spiritual care? I know, I heard of it, I haven't heard of it, but no one ever gave a good definition. Can you?
Yeah, I think it's... It doesn't. Those ultimate issues and those, you know, there's spiritual care has a lot of dimensions, and you know what happens after death, what's the meaning of life, and some of those deep philosophical, theological questions, and ministering to address those is very, very important. And if those don't get addressed, there's kind of a spirit wrenching issue. And so, one of the things. This might be helpful at sharing this story. Trained chaplains, clinical pastoral education at Catholic Health Services. We have Mary Tue O'Neill, who's nationally, internationally famous for training chaplains in the spiritual care of patients, the pastoral care of patients in these situations, dealing with patients and families. But when I was a chaplain at University of Vermont, and this story shows the importance of the nursing staff, the medical community, being in touch with the spiritual needs of the patient. I got a call from the pediatric nurses, and they said, could you come visit this family? And they're struggling. They have a 4-year-old child and a 2-year-old child who's in and out of the hospital, born with solid tumors throughout his body. Always pain is normal for him, but he's a good-natured kid, and the family are struggling with this issue. And the situation was there's a little bit of religious diversity in the family, and there was the father was Jewish, the mother was Jewish, formerly Catholic. Her mother was very, very Catholic. His mother was very, very Jewish. And the extended family, here's a 27-year-old father and a 25-year-old mother with a 2-year-old child who the nurses said is not going to make it to his third Christmas/Hanukkah. And so I went and visited, and you know, you can feel the love of parents. They really love this child with all their heart, and they just were struggling with the meaning of life and why suffering. And, you know, I would gladly, they said, exchange anything if I could have that burden and my son could be healthy. But the nurses said, this is a happy, happy kid. You know, there's just some people like that. No matter what, they're happy.
Yeah,
and they got a lot of meaning out of serving this child. And they said, could you talk with the family? And they just wanted to love. And I said, we'd work with the priest and the rabbi to maybe have an appreciation for religious diversity. And they were arguing what they weren't going to do at the funeral or what they were going to do at the funeral. And then, you know, after about 45 minutes, I left. I got called back by the nurses. It was All Souls Day, November 2nd. And they said, come quickly. The baby could pass away today. Mm. And I was met by the Catholic grandmother at the bed, and she says, it's a bad time to come, baby's not doing well. And I said, well, I was the chaplain that I knew her daughter and son-in-law and the baby. And so we gathered around the room and we prayed to pray. I said a few things that the parents told me that night. I met with them earlier, and then 3 nurses were in the room at the time who had served this patient over the years, and it was like God spoke through them. I can't remember what they said, but you could feel a difference in the room. The presence of God was just more manifest. And then from what those nurses said, the family members said wonderful things, fulfilling the wishes of the parents.
Yeah.
And then we got to the Jewish grandmother, and she said, maybe we should pray the Our Father. Yes. And so we held hands. We prayed the Our Father. The second we finished, the baby turned his head, looked at his mother, looked at his father, and died.
Oh, you're making me cry.
I know.
You're making me cry.
I've told that story a couple of times, but it's just, you could feel God in the room.
Absolutely. Oh, my Lord.
And in that instant, 3 generations of family were healed, I believe.
For the pool.
It's important.
Yeah.
Can you say a prayer, pray for our petitions and pray for our listeners, and specifically pray for this little boy that we know that's going, suffering with cancer. And is
and his name is David.
His name is David, and is those last stages. And also pray for a beautiful woman named Alice that passed away, that was a great fan of our show, and is being buried today. So, Brother Paul, can you lead us in prayer so that when we sign off, we'll sign off with praying to Jesus. Thank you, Paul.
In the name of the Father, the Son, and the
Holy Spirit. Amen.
Lord, you said ask and you shall receive. Seek and you shall find. Knock and the door will be opened to you. And so I bring the petitions of those who are listening to this radio program and those who are on this radio program and those who make this radio program possible. And I commit them to your sacred heart. And I ask that you bless them and heal them in body, mind, and soul, according to your will. I ask you to be moved by these petitions, to move by the tears of Martha and Mary, of their beloved brother Lazarus, to move by your mother's request at the marriage ceremony at Cana, to move by the faithful Samaritan woman who believes she'll be healed by touching the top of your cloak. I thank you, Lord, for the many times when you've intervened in the past, especially on behalf of those for whom we have just prayed. And I look forward with peace, hope, and joy to future coming for the conversion of souls. Jesus, I trust in you. Jesus, I trust in you. Jesus, I trust in you. In the name of the Father,
Son, and Holy Spirit. Amen.
Amen.
Thank you, brother. Spence, would you like to say a prayer?
That was wonderful from Father Paul. I think maybe a song or...
A song might do.
Joan, would you like to say a prayer?
I would just like to say that I'd like to pray that the Spirit of God would always be with these people who have to make these really awesome and terrible decisions, and that he is with them always.
And I give you praise and glory, and thank you, Jesus. Thank you for allowing us to do this radio show. Thank you for allowing us to do it for 5 years, which we never, ever thought we would. So thank you. Thank you, Dr. Palmer, for watching over us. Thank you. Thank you, Spence, for being on the show.
Thank you, Spence.
Thank you, Brother Paul, for co-hosting. And Joni, thank you. Thank you for being my wife. Thank you.
Wait a minute. There must have been one time that I told you to jump off a bridge. There had to be at least
one time. Someone's texted me and says, next time she tells you, listen to her. Okay, so let's go out with a song.
Heal Me.
Is it Heal Me that we want to play?
H, yeah.
Okay.
The views expressed in the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
Thank you, listeners. We love you.
From the heart of the nautical mile, you're listening to the station that serves your community, AM 1240 WGBB.com and 1240 WGBB Freeport.